Okay, folks, thank you very much for joining Ms. Leslie Ann Jones and myself, the Portmeister, or Michael Paris, I'm better known, for the very first podcast of the year 2021. I'm not going to say Happy New Year to anybody, including yourself, Leslie Ann, because I have this thing that if anybody says Happy New Year to me anytime after midday on New Year's Day, I'm afraid I just dismiss them as being a freak. As far as I'm concerned, you know, New Year's Day happens in about the 4 hours after midnight on the morning of New Year's Day, and then we get on with our lives. Christmas is over, New Year's Eve is over, and life returns to normal.
You think? Is your Christmas tree still up?
Sorry?
Is your Christmas tree still up?
No. That all went. That goes immediately on January the 1st. I had a silver Christmas tree. In fact, I had three, actually. It was called a forest of trees, okay? And yes, that's right. And there is not a mark, as I speak to you now, that there's ever been any sort of Christmas or New Year celebration taking place in this abode of mine. I won't have it. As far as I'm concerned, we've got enough to contend with this year, 2021. We've got a huge recovery to engineer ourselves and to help the country engineer. And I think we've got to get on with that as quickly as possible.
You should see my house. The tree is still up. It actually has stood up very well this year. It stayed very green. We watered it.
Yeah.
Still there. All the nativity scenes are still hanging around. Christmas cake, boxes of Twiglets, after eights, the whole lot. It's all still there.
This is Saddo territory. Or whatever the female equivalent of a saddo is, a saddess. You know, this is saddess territory. You can't be hanging around hoping that, you know, a lingering feeling of the joy of Christmas and New Year will stay with you into January. I mean, I think that's non-starter territory.
Well, it isn't that. We've always held to the 12th night thing of dismantling Christmas on the 6th of January. That has been since my childhood, so we always do that. But the other thing is I've just been too busy. I haven't had any time to even think about taking all this stuff down because I'm writing a book. So everything else goes by the wayside. The kids aren't going to do it, are they? So, you know,
I don't know. I think you should discipline your children a bit more, perhaps. You know, it seems to me like you've got you running around left, right and centre doing everything for them. And it's not like they're toddlers. I mean, it's like they're grown people.
Yeah, I am getting a bit fed up with it now, to be honest.
Yeah, and of course, being a man of religious zealotry, I know that the 6th, of course, is Epiphany, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. It is the 6th. It's traditionally when the three wise men came to Jesus in the stable and brought their gifts and paid homage and so on. But I think in different parts of Europe, it's celebrated on different days. And of course, all the centuries are concertinaed together. So we're never quite sure what happened precisely. But it's representative of the events that took place around the birth of Jesus.
Indeed. Now, I happened to read, actually, only I think this morning, or it might have been last night, that your friend, the Rev, in Fleet Street at St Bride's, they've had to close the church down again.
I'm afraid we have, yes. A couple of cases of COVID-19 in the church, and the Reverend is now self-isolating because she had close contact with both those people. So for everybody's safety, the church is currently closed, which is terribly sad, but only until the 11th of January, and that will be reviewed after then.
Yeah, we might find the whole country's closed down by then. It looks to me like, you know, I saw Boris this morning. And, you know, I have a lot of admiration for a lot of things Boris has done. He's got Brexit done in the end. But I'm sorry, lockdowns don't work for me. It looks like we're going to go into full tier 5 lockdown. I mean, it's going to be so miserable. Friends of mine are now really suffering mental health problems, genuinely feeling the pressure of being confined and finding no way out.
I think this is what's going on with my kids as well. My youngest daughter, Bridie, was meant to start a new job today as a teaching assistant in a school in Kensington. But of course, the school hasn't reopened, so there is no job to go to currently. My son is furloughed from his job, but he's also waiting to go to work in the West End as a performer. My other daughter has resumed her job today at Island Records, and you know, she's working away upstairs, but it's not the same. Yeah, people need to be getting out of their house and getting to their jobs. And unfortunately, I think you're right. I think there will be another full-blown lockdown, and I think this will last for some time.
Yeah, it could last till Easter. I was doing some radio shows in the last couple of days, talking to economists and people. They're terribly optimistic that there's going to be a massive economic boom when it all gets lifted again. You know, they've got about £1,000 billion in people's pockets ready to be spent and all this kind of stuff. Well, that's all very well. But, you know, we've got to get there first, haven't we?
Yeah, I think, well, no one's spent any money, have we, really? I think a few people dipped in their pockets for Christmas presents and so on, but nobody's travelled anywhere, nobody's needed new clothes, nobody's done any work on their houses. Yeah. So I think, yes, people do have money put aside, the lucky ones, and there will be an economic recovery. We have to believe in that.
Yes, no, definitely. Do you remember Edwina Curry?
Yeah, Edwina. Yeah,
well, sorry?
Egwina, as we call her.
Egwina, that's right. Yeah, lost her job because she said all eggs had got salmonella in them when she was a junior health minister. But I spoke to her in the last couple of days, and she's always very lively, you know, she's got loads of opinions and all that. But she made the mistake of saying that, no, no, it's going to be wonderful. Everybody's got money to spend. She said, in fact, I've invested in a pile of shares in Carnival cruise liners.
Oh,
you know,
because
I'd said to her, I said, but all these cruise liners, all the ships are parked in the Solent on the south coast, said going nowhere. I said, you know, it's absolutely nil economic activity. So she said, yes, yes, but it's all going to boom. I bought the shares. God, the abuse I got back, you know, from listeners on the radio stations. It's all very well for her, you know, buying all the shares in cruise liners and all that. What about the people who've lost their jobs? So,
exactly.
You know, there are two ways to look at it, I suppose.
Yeah. I think if you've got money to invest in shares, you ought to keep very quiet about it.
Yeah, I think so as well.
Because it's not fair. You know, especially I was talking to people over the weekend who, all their friends are musicians. They are musicians. They work in the music industry.
Yeah.
So everybody you know has their livelihood ripped away from them and has no income at all at the moment.
Yeah.
And
no,
that is many, many people that I know currently. So we all need to be a bit kinder about people who are really struggling.
Yeah, I totally agree. But you know what Edwina's like, you know, she's always full of energy. Funny enough, a few years ago, I was coming back from an England game at Wembley, okay? And it's a night game, and I always get out a bit early to try and get, you know, beat the crowd back into London to get to Surrey. And I was on a tube train from, not Paddington, what's that station up there that goes up to Wembley? I forgot what it's called now.
Marylebone,
well done. Yeah, that's right, yeah. And between there and sort of Victoria. And I noticed this woman standing up on her own, and there were a load of sort of football fans on the same show. And nobody would get up and give this lady a seat. So I got up and offered her a seat, and it was Edwina Curry. And she was so grateful, she put out a blog about it the next day. You know, this lovely man on the tube train and all this kind of stuff. Yeah.
Perhaps she thought you fancied her.
Well, funny enough, do you remember Tim Miles, obviously? He used to be on the Mail. Tim Miles, we once had this conversation in the bar, and I don't know how we got onto the subject, but he said, I once met Edwina Curry. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, I was over at the House of Commons doing something, some committee or something. I met her. He said, she is the sexiest woman I've ever met. I said, Tim, what do you mean? Because then Edwina was a junior minister. She was married to a husband and all that kind of stuff. Nobody had yet heard about the revelations that came years later when she'd had a bit of a fling with John Major, right? But
down to the point that we knew the label in his underpants.
Well, and that he sat with his back to the taps in the bath. What about that?
She sat the other end.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
God.
That was the revelation. Yeah, yeah. But sorry, Edwina, perhaps too much information. But anyway.
No, but she said it all herself. So, you know, we only know it because of her.
No, she did. She revealed it in a book, I think, that she wrote. But anyway, to the shock of Mrs. Major, I would think. But Tim said, God, you know, what a sexy woman. I said, what do you mean? I said, you know, she's, you know, with no disrespect to Edwina, I said, she's sort of okay looking. She's sort of middle-aged. Oh, he said, I don't know, something about her. He said, you know, it really struck home. So she must have something. But anyway, there we are.
Well, do you remember Mrs. Tim Miles?
Oh, yes, of course I do. Fearsome woman, Wendy Henry.
Yes. Yeah, so there was obviously a type going on there, is all I'm saying.
Well, you know, whatever. I wouldn't cross Wendy, believe me. Fearsome, former editor of the News of the World. Anyway, listen, you know, it's all very well. One thing we have to talk about, it's only happened in the last few hours, the death has been announced of Jerry Marsden.
Yeah, very sad. Very, very sad to hear that. What a lovely guy he was. And he was only 78. Yeah.
Yeah.
He actually had a pacemaker, you know, which I...
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Yeah, and later in life.
Funny. He did joke about that. But no, he was taken into hospital on Boxing Day. They found an infection in his blood that had gone into his heart. He'd had a lot of trouble with his heart. He'd had a bypass, aortic valve replacement, and that pacemaker and so on. And it was all very quick. And the saddest part was that his daughters and his wife weren't able to be with him in the hospital because of current restrictions about visitors. So he died all by himself. He was very much a family man, so that would have been so sad for all of them.
Yeah, big mate, obviously, of the Beatles. And I put out a tweet about him because you've got to remember, he didn't compose the song You'll Never Walk Alone. He nicked it from Carousel, didn't he? The musical, is that right?
Yeah, it was, no, it wasn't nicked, but the song did come from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical Carousel, But, of course, it became the great anthem of all time, didn't it, as far as football fans are concerned?
Well, as far as Liverpool fans are concerned, yes. But did you know that in Scotland, Celtic claim it's their own?
Yeah, I think lots of people do. In other countries around the world as well,
Do they? Oh, right, OK, yeah. But anyway, the point is, so I put out a tweet and I just said, you know, really sorry to hear of the death of Jerry Francis. I never held
Jerry Marsden even.
Yeah, sorry, Jerry Francis is still alive. He's a former football manager. Sorry, Jerry. And I said, I never held Walk On, which is what I used to call the record, against you. I said, but you were an iconic figure and, you know, a leading member of the Merseybeat in the 60s, which was a terrific part of the cultural history of this country. And, you know, 99% of the responses I got were great stuff, Mike, and all that, and, you know, nicely said and all that. But the odd one would say, how dare you raise, you know, an issue against a man who's just died? I think they don't understand the Merseyside humour. Jerry Marsden would have been, you know, quite touched by that. You know what I mean? An Evertonian had paid tribute to him.
Oh, he would have laughed his head off. Take no notice. Did you see the picture that I tweeted of us together?
No, I didn't. When was that?
Yeah, last night.
Oh, no, I didn't know.
Lovely picture of myself, Jerry Marsden and David Wigg.
Oh, Wiggy, right, okay, yeah. And where was that?
That was taken at a theatre in Chatham in about 2013. It was one of those gold 60s or silver 60s tours, you know, with all the great sort of artists from before on the road together. And Wiggy and I were great friends, we still are, with Frank Allen, the bass player in the Searchers.
So
we were there for that reason. Yeah. And we fell in with Jerry that night, and he was such a laugh and so welcoming. Yeah. And, you know, come and see me anytime you're in Liverpool and so on. And and I did meet him again, and he was true to his word, a very generous, loving, life-loving man.
Yeah.
And he will be sorely missed.
No, he well, I totally agree. Funny you should say that. I went to watch Everton play at Southampton one time, and to get to the Southampton ground, you go down to the Southampton station, obviously come out, and there's a theatre next door. I think it might be called The Mermaid or something. I can't remember. But funny enough, all the banners were up for that tour you're talking about, starring Jerry and the Pacemakers. Yeah. He took it all around the country, didn't he? Yeah,
he did.
But anyway, look, talking about great pop stars and all that, I don't know if she is a great pop star, really, but Marianne Faithfull is 74. How about that? Did you ever come across her?
Never met her, no, but I just read over the weekend that Lucy Boynton, you know who played Mary Austin in Bohemian Rhapsody, the Queen film?
Oh, yes.
She is about to play Marianne Faithfull in the biopic of her life.
Oh, really? Golly, I mean, what an extraordinary woman Marianne Faithfull was. Because, of course, for those who are a little younger than us, she was, of course, the original girlfriend of Mick Jagger, wasn't she?
Yeah, a little unlike Edwina Curry, we'd have to say.
How do you mean?
Well, I don't think Edwina Curry probably ever had a Mars bar in quite the way that Marianne Faithfull did.
Please, excuse me, this family show, That particular notorious episode has been denied many times by the policeman who barged into Keith Richards' home and arrested them all for taking drugs. No, not going there. No mention of Mars bars in this podcast.
So you've never done that then?
Sorry?
You've never done that then?
Excuse me, I'm not going there, Miss Jones. For goodness sake, you know, God, blimey, I don't know. But anyway, all I was going to say was she fell from grace very quickly as soon as Mick Jagger, you know, and her split up and he went off and married Bianca Jagger. Well, I suppose, what was Bianca's name before she was Jagger? Can't remember.
Something Brazilian.
Oh, was it? Yeah, something like that, yeah. But
It wasn't actually something Brazilian.
Oh, a Brazilian name, yeah. No, but she wasn't. She was like Colombian or something, wasn't she?
South American, anyway.
South American, that's right, yeah. But no.
Nicaraguan. I think she may have been Nicaraguan.
That's right, Nicaraguan, that's right. Yeah, she used to go there and help out with the war, didn't she? Whichever side she might have been on, yeah. But, anyway.
Help out with the war.
Yeah. But anyway, on one occasion, God knows why, I was sent down to some address in Cheyne Walk, right? Because we found out that Marianne Faithfull had moved in as a squatter, believe it or not. You
brilliant.
Know. Yeah, and this must have been in the 80s when I worked at the Express in London, you know. And this is a family show, so brace yourself. But I knocked on the door and a voice came from a window upstairs and said, "Who is it?" And I said, "Oh, hi." I said, "Is that Marianne?" She said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Mike Parr from the Daily Express." And she said, "Well, fuck off." And and then closed the window. And that was it. That's as far as I got.
I think you probably made a mistake by saying you were Mike Parry from the Daily Express.
Well, yeah, but you see, you know, that's a two-edged sword, because if you tried to infiltrate the property by trying to be somebody else, you get yourself into all sorts of trouble. I was a very honourable man in those days.
Very honourable man now.
Anyway, listen, I'll tell you who I want to talk to you about, right, because I'm fascinated by him. A guy's died, a top fashion designer, Pierre Cardin.
Yeah. He who didn't design the Beatles' collarless jackets.
Although
it said in all the obituaries, it said Pierre Cardin famously designed the Beatles' collarless jackets. Yeah. He didn't. That was a guy called Dougie Millings, in fact, who he had a shop at 63 Old Compton Street in Soho. Yeah. And he used to design for Cliff, Tommy Steele, Adam Faith, all of those guys. He made more than 500 sets of suits for the Beatles.
God, did he?
Yeah. Not only that, but he was in A Hard Day's Night playing a tailor, kind of a blink and you'll miss him sort of part.
Right.
And he made the stage suits also for the film Help.
Did he? God.
Yeah, so it's nothing to do with Pierre Cardin.
Yeah, well, it doesn't surprise me that Pierre Cardin, yeah, would have claimed it, because, of course, I read all the obituaries. There's a great one in the Telegraph, and it was very long. And it said his favourite subject to talk about was himself, and he never stopped talking about himself. Okay, you know, he was a super egocentric bloke. And how about this here? He says, "Let me see. When I get up in the morning, that's right, it's here. Right. When I get up in the morning, I can wake up in the morning and shave with one of my razors, use my own aftershave, and dress in Pierre Cardin." From my tie to my pants to my shirt. Then I go to my Pierre Cardin restaurant, Maxim's de Paris, or I go to my Pierre Cardin theatre. Everything in my house is Pierre Cardin too, even what I eat, because I have a range of food products and drinks, and I eat on cutlery, which is Pierre Cardin. I mean, everything in his life was about himself.
Well, that is either the ultimate egotist or it's somebody with a very low self-esteem who has to stamp their name all over everything.
Well, it was low self-esteem. The same obituary says he was born as the youngest of 11 children into poverty in Italy. He was Italian, in fact, not French. And he, you know, strove all his life to make him something of himself, you know, so quite admire him, really. I thought, because I'm not very sort of fashion conscious, I thought for years that Pierre Cardin was the top of the range, you know what I mean? So when I was in Debenhams once and I saw some Pierre Cardin shirts, I thought, well, I'll get some of these and then that will impress people, you know, because it's got Pierre Cardin sort of embroidered in the...
Do you want to say that again?
Pierre Cardin. embroidered in the collar, you see what I mean?
But then I think the clue was the fact that they were for sale in Debenhams.
Well, no, I thought that was okay. What the clue to the fact was that from then on, I got roundly mocked for wearing them, because not only with the sale in Debenhams, Mike Ashley, who runs Sports Direct and flogs extremely cheap stuff, you know, to the masses, had bought a huge pile of Pierre Cardin shirts and was flogging them in Sports Direct. So everybody accused me of buying my shirts at Mike Ashley's Sports Direct shop. And I spent the rest of my life denying the fact that I'd ever bought anything from Sports Direct in the way of fashion. I only ever bought trainers there, you know.
You can't win, can you, really?
Can't win. But a very, really colourful guy and somebody that I'd like to know more about. Did you ever come across Elizabeth Taylor?
Yeah, I did. I interviewed her for You magazine many years ago.
Right. And how was she?
Yeah, I liked her, actually. Feisty bird. And I think she was more famous for her marriages, wasn't she, than for any film roles, really, apart from Cleopatra, which we all saw and absolutely loved the eye makeup and had to try and do that and always end up looking like a panda.
But
and she stole a couple of husbands off other women, which probably wasn't a good idea, but... she famously married Richard Burton twice, and he was the love of her life.
Yes, that's right. She married seven times altogether, including to Burton twice. But the reason I raise this is because it's the anniversary of her divorce from a guy called, he was that American senator fellow, what was his name?
John Warner,
who was her fifth husband. And when asked why she's divorced, she said, "I'm bored stiff of being a politician's wife. It's not the
life." Or did she say that he was a bored stiff?
No, I think we're getting into dangerous territory here again, Miss Jones. You know what I mean? Excuse me, you know what I mean? But I mean...
I tell you what else as well. Do you remember that builder she married? Larry Fortensky?
Yes, Larry Fortensky. Yeah, that was amazing. I think that was her last husband. And he was, you're right. He worked on a building site. She picked him up off a building site. And he had hair like an old friend of ours called Mr. Roger Tavener, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah, sort of yellow almost.
Yeah.
You know those hats that the builders wear, the construction site workers, as they call them in America, wear? The sort of yellow hard hats.
Yes.
There wasn't much difference between that and his actual hair.
No, there wasn't. No, that's right.
And she must have had eight husbands in that case. Because there was... Yeah. Conrad Hilton, wasn't there, the first one? That lasted a year. And then Michael Wilding. Mike Todd died. That lasted a year. And then Mike Todd, he died. Michael Wilding, she had. Yeah. Eddie Fisher, who was Carrie Fisher's dad, was Debbie Reynolds. Debbie Reynolds was the... And then two Richard Burtons and a John Warner and then Larry Fortensky. So I make that eight marriages altogether.
Really? Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. You know more about it than I do. But you say that she was only famous in one film, but you're absolutely right. She was more famous for her marriages. And in particular, the fact that Richard Burton would always buy her the world's most expensive diamond, wouldn't he?
Well, there was that. Was it the Koh-i Noor diamond or
something like that?
The heaviest it had been found in India, hadn't it? And it was the hugest, most beautiful diamond you'd ever seen in your life. And he bought her that.
Yeah. What used to read it? Used to read that, you know, a mystery buyer has bought this fantastic diamond, or a mystery buyer has bought this fucking great yacht. Excuse my language. It's a family show, isn't it? this great yacht. And the next day it'd be revealed that Richard Burton had bought the diamond for Elizabeth Taylor, and Richard Burton had bought the yacht to take his new bride on honeymoon and all this kind of stuff. They were a very glamorous couple, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, they were. I think at the time as well, that level of wealth in Hollywood stars, we haven't quite got there yet. It wasn't the norm, was it?
No.
So to imagine that some little Welsh guy from a valley called Richard Burton had gone and become one of the power couples of the entire world and had made such a fortune, that was all so glamorous and so unbelievable to us. Whereas now we're sort of steeped in it with the Kardashians and so on, and it's all become a bit vulgar. It was glamorous in those days.
Sure, sure. No, I totally agree. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Myself, Mr. Michael Powery, the Portmeister, and of course, Leslie Ann Jones, a rock chick writer extraordinaire. You said in the first part of this programme, Leslie Ann, that you're busy writing a book. Which book are you writing at the moment?
Oh, this is called Love of My Life.
Right.
And it's a very in-depth examination of various relationships and friendships of Freddie Mercury.
Oh, right. There you go. Well, that's excellent. And of course, we're all locked in. We've talked about that already. Do you have any stress busters? The reason I ask you is because I read about somebody who's got a Tibetan bell. No joke. And this bell they place on their table when they're working, like you know, they're sort of desk bound and all this kind of stuff. And every now and then they have to pick up the bell and ring it because it's got to shake away the demons in their head, which leads to depression, all that kind of stuff.
I'm not sure how I feel about that. I think there's a lot to be said for a hot water bottle, especially at this time of year. And I have one behind my back as we speak.
Really?
So it's a nice, warm, comforting thing. Some people like teddy bears to cuddle. I think there's no substitute for proper healthcare, mental healthcare, I mean, if you really do have a problem.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
See your doctor and get some medication.
Yeah, maybe.
But there are things like, you know, sniffing peppermint oil, taking B-complex vitamins, getting yeah. plenty of sleep.
Really?
Those head massages that you can buy, they're pretty good. Colouring books. A lot of people like these adult colouring books, don't they, which are said to relieve stress. I always go for the scented candles, the lavender, the chamomile tea, and all those things work for me, so they're worth a try.
I always go for beer. That's the best one, honestly. A couple of pints of beer. Seriously, bottled beer. Now, it's got to be, obviously. My vintner is now bringing me 24 bottles of beer a week. Good chap, every Saturday. So that's excellent.
Champagne works as well, I've got to say.
Champagne as well. But also, I've got a stress ball with Kadanga written on it, okay?
And what's that mean?
It's Hindu for peace. And I do carry that around sometimes when I'm feeling, you know, if I feel, you know, I'm a bit stressed out and all, I go and squeeze my my squash ball, as I call it. But it's
can I have a squeeze of your ball next time we meet?
God, I don't know. Any opportunity, honestly, I don't know. There we go. Listen, talking about birthdays, because we've missed a few while we've been away. Jeff Lynne, 73. He's quite an accomplished musician, old Jeff Lynne, isn't he?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, he plays everything.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But he also produces, doesn't he, for other people and writes and all sorts of things.
Yeah, most famously, I think. He co-founded the Travelling Wilburys with George Harrison and Bob Dylan, Roy Orbison, Tom Petty. And he also co-produced the Beatles anthology, you know, the reunion singles
from
the John Lennon demos. So there were,
That was with George Martin's son, wasn't it? Didn't he do it?
Giles, yes. Yeah, Free as a Bird and Real Love were the two.
As a bird.
Oh, God, here we go.
Yeah. Oh, I love that song. But
very beautiful. And Real Love, of course, which Tom O'Dell did a cover of a few years back for the John Lewis Christmas advert, I think. But, of course, I'd much, much rather have the original.
Yes, well, no, I would as well. And, of course, we can't have a Planet Porky podcast without mentioning a member of the Beatles. Do you see that story that your mate Macca, that's Sir Paul McCartney, pictures of him and other celebs in St. Bart at the moment, jumping off boats into the sparkling Caribbean Sea. That would be some place to be at the moment, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it be a dream? Yes.
And what I was going to say was that I read a piece from Macca that when he enters his Sussex Farm grounds or whatever, you've probably been there, I suppose.
I have been there. I used to go there and see Linda when we were working on a book together.
Okay, so just tell me, how many places have you got in the country? Because I always thought years ago, my mate lived down in Maidstone, and he said that McCartney had a place down in Kent near Lyme.
There's a recording studio near there, which is a sort of windmill. Recording studio. But it's sort of more Sussex, I would have said. Peasmarsh is where his main home is.
That's what I mean. Is Peasmarsh in Kent or is it in Sussex?
I think it must be Kent-Sussex borders.
Oh, I see. Right, OK. And has it got, for instance, the big story we were told locally was that he was on tour in Europe then and he had that Dakota aeroplane made famous by Led Zeppelin and he used to fly into Europe and fly back at night with his children home.
Well, he did have a private plane. I never saw it. I never went on it. But wherever he played a gig, yes, he made a point. He and Linda always made a point of going home to be with the kids.
That's right,
Rather than staying the night. They didn't stay in hotels. But he lives most of the time these days on Long Island. He's got a place in the Hamptons.
Oh, the Hamptons,
and
lovely.
And his daughter, Stella, has a house very nearby as well. Because his wife is American, Nancy.
Of course.
And she had a house on the Hamptons, and that was how they met.
Yeah,
it was
exactly.
A dinner party in one of those homes.
Really, yeah. Because the Hamptons is like the sort of Kensington, isn't it, of London?
Well, it's out on a limb, isn't it? So, you know, Long Island is...
Yeah, sure.
You take the Long Island Railroad or you get in your car and drive for 4 hours.
Yes,
and
exactly.
You sort of drive away from New York. And it's a very beautiful place.
Oh, it is, yeah.
It's there's a lot of money there. The landscapes are divine.
Oh, totally agree.
A lot of rich people live, especially in places like East Hampton and Southampton.
It's great. Anyway, the point of my story is, this story said that there's a pine tree near the entrance to Paul's estate, his estate in Sussex or Kent or wherever it is, and Paul believes the spirit of George Harrison is apparent in that tree, based on the fact that George, of course, was a very keen gardener, wasn't he, in his later years, as evidenced by the cover of All Things Must Pass.
Yeah, I think I read that piece. I think what he was really saying is not that the spirit of George has gone into that tree and that's what he believes, but Paul was saying that George gave him that fir tree as a present. And that because he sees the tree every day when he drives out of his gate.
Yes.
Whenever he looks at that tree, he thinks of George. It reminds him of George. And so that's like a comforting thing rather than, oh, guess what? My fir tree, the ghost of George is living in it. You know, I don't think it's quite as mystical as that.
No.
It's an interesting thing because after my dad died last year, I gave, must be the year before now, I suppose, because we're in 2021. Hmm. I saw a piece on the news about an old chap who was living in a care home. And every night he took to bed with him a framed photograph, a silver framed photograph of his late wife. And one of the young nurses felt so sorry for him.
They put it on a cushion for him.
Yeah, she put the photograph on a cushion and gave it to him, and he was cuddling that. And I got one done for my mother. I had a similar cushion made for my mother. And it's a very strange thing because my mother talks to this cushion, as though it is my dad. She also wraps it up at night in blankets and things so that he doesn't get cold during the night.
Really?
And it's quite bizarre. It's as if it's become my dad.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is this thing that perhaps we keep the idea of people alive in quite physical ways. Yeah. Those things have got to be to comfort us rather than anything to do with keeping a memory alive, haven't they?
Yeah, do you know, I thought that was a bit spooky when I saw exactly the same story as you. An old fella who was, you know, clearly in his dotage, and a really young, lovely young nurse, probably in her late teens or early 20s. And she walked in and she had the cushion turned towards her and said, oh, look, George, whatever his name was, I've got a present for you. And she turned it round. And at first he smiled and then he burst into tears.
Yeah.
And it was very touching. But I thought, golly, you know, would I really want my, you know, dead wife, you know, her head on a cushion next to me as I sleep at night? I'd find that really spooky. And so I'm not saying that that's the same with your mum, but doesn't it just elongate a memory that's now gone and you should really say, look, it's over?
Well, I mean, it sort of gets worse than that, really, because my mum still has my dad's ashes in the front sitting room, in the urn, in a box, in a rubber sort of carrier bag thing.
Yeah.
And every time I go there, I look at that and think, well, part of me is a bit shaken by it.
Yes.
And part of me is thinking, oh, it's not really my dad. You know, but there is an odd thing about letting a deceased person go.
Yes.
And I feel that we're not doing that at the moment.
Yeah. Well, look, that's a family thing for you and your mum. There's no way I'm going to criticise your mother or anything like that. But I still, how do you tell these things? I think it's better to go and distribute ashes somewhere where you've enjoyed such great times or something, you know, on Lake Windermere or over the edge of a cliff or something like that. You know what I mean? Because then it's gone, and then they've gone, you know, they've sort of been picked up by the wind and they're on the way to heaven and all that. But anyway, look, enough more.
Or you could do what Keith Richards did and smoke your father's ashes.
Smoke your father's ashes. Or you could do, I suppose, what Paula Yates did and sew them into your pillow if you're Michael Hutchins' ashes. And she slept with them every night, didn't she?
Yeah, that is a bit odd, I suppose.
That is very odd indeed. Anyway, get away from those odd things. Now, listen, did you ever go to Jacko's Neverland Estate in California?
Yes. Went there once. What a very odd place. Yeah, it's it was like Disneyland, like a whole Disneyland for someone to live in. It had its own railway and a train station and a fire station and a cinema and pool house and all
and
that.
A fairground.
And rides. Yes, rides. So it was like a Disneyland. This was obviously an expression of Michael Jackson's very troubled and distraught childhood.
Yes.
He was reliving his own childhood by creating that place for kids to come and experience things they wouldn't otherwise enjoy because they were deprived.
No, I agree.
There's a big place next door to it called Zacher Lake.
Right.
And I know that the guy who sort of owns most of the Soho House chain now was going to buy that place and turn it into a new Soho house, but didn't in the end because it was too remote. And he's now bought Neverland.
He's bought Neverland. That's what I was going to tell you, see, because it's been sold for $22 million after being listed for sale 5 years ago for $100 million. So that's what it was worth then. The last public offer was $31 million. That sale didn't go through. Now sold for $22 million. And you're absolutely right. It's been sold to a guy called Burkle, Ron Burkle, who is a billionaire and also a former financial advisor to Michael Jackson, who's sort of picked it up cheap. I wonder what they'll do with it. I mean, what can you do with a building which is so intrinsically linked to Michael Jackson? Apart from making it a sort of a Michael Jackson tribute sort of property, what could you do with it?
Well, they might. He might turn it into a museum of some kind, because there still are millions of people around the world who revere Michael Jackson,
right, there are,
regardless of everything else that's gone on.
Yeah.
So it's possible he might do that, but it is in quite a remote location. It's not easy to get to.
Right.
So, you know, we'll have to see. But the Soho House chain, of which I am a founder member, by the way.
Right, good.
And I'm also an Every House member, so I belong to all the clubs all over the world.
Excellent.
And I've been that since 1995. So the clubs I visited, there are 27. I've done the London ones, so Soho, Notting Hill, Mayfair, Shoreditch House, New York, Chicago, LA, Barcelona, Amsterdam. I've still got to get to India and Istanbul and places like that. But
really?
I like the idea of Neverland becoming the latest Soho house.
I think I'm also right in thinking, if it's the same guy, haven't Soho House just bought Langham's, the famous restaurant on Piccadilly in Mayfair?
Oh, they may have done, they may have done, because it was Nick Jones founded Soho House in 95.
Yes.
He sold 80% of his shareholding to Richard Caring in 2008.
Yeah, remember him? He's got doesn't he own Annabelle's?
Annabelle's and Caprice and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I think 4 years later or so, Richard Caring sold about 60% of the group to this guy, Ron Burkle.
Right, okay.
So I know that Nick still got about 10%.
Right, okay.
And Richard Caring must still have about 30%. And old Ron Burkle has got the rest. So this is how investment banking works, isn't it, really?
I think it does. Money just goes kind of around in circles. So did you go there to see Jacko himself?
Yes.
And did you get in and see him?
Yeah, definitely, because I went with a guy called Jonathan Morrish, who I knew from CBS Sony days, donkeys years ago. But he was Michael Jackson's right-hand man. He was his confidant in London. And also Jonathan's daughter, Mimi, was Michael's goddaughter.
Blimey. Circles within circles. Now, tell me this, Miss Jones. You're a woman who likes to keep herself in shape, keep supple and all that. Have you got yourself a leotard? Because leotards, Jane Fonda style, are back in vogue and back in fashion here in 2021.
I think I've still got some of my original leotards. I went through a phase of wearing them all the time with tights underneath jeans and jumpers and stuff.
Right.
Which was all the rage some years ago. But I'm not sure I could fit into them anymore. I'll have to have a look.
Yeah. I don't like leotards because to me they look like swimsuits and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? And I can never
swimsuits
work out.
With arms, aren't they? The only thing was, if you wore them with tights underneath, under your jeans, under a jumper, every time you went to the ladies, you had to take it all off.
Oh well, I think too much information there, Miss Jones, for our male audience, if you don't mind. I think we'll move on from that. Moving on from that to Miss Courtney, by the way. This sounds very unsavoury as well. Courtney Kardashian has shared an article about being autosexual.
Stop. That is a very touchy subject, what I mean.
Oh, I'm not going there either. I'm sorry.
Family show, Michael.
Oh, dear me. Listen, I tell you what I'm going to talk to you about, something a lot more wholesome, and that is the fact that the food of the year for 2021 is going to be seaweed. What do you think about that?
Well, that is no surprise to me, being a Welsh girl, you know, because lava bread is one of our staples, isn't it?
Is it? Yeah.
Have you never had lava bread?
Maybe. Presumably lava bread's made of lava. Lava comes out of sort of volcanoes. What's that got to do with seaweed?
No, not at all. Lava bread is made of seaweed. It's a type of edible seaweed. The Irish call it slake. You boil it and it boils down to a dark green pulp, a bit like spinach. It's very rich in things like iron, iodine, protein, vitamin B2, that kind of stuff.
Right.
It tastes a bit like oysters or olives, you know, that sort of quite tangy flavour because of the iodine in it.
I've never had an oyster because they look too slippery for me. And you're supposed to throw them down your throat, aren't you, without chewing them, aren't you?
Yeah, elephant snot, my brother calls oysters.
Oh, my God. Goodness gracious. I don't know levels to which you will sink in this Planet Pulpy podcast.
I tell you what, lava bread, I used to order it. There's a place in Gower in Wales. It's a website. Anyone can find it, called the Celtic Crab Products, celticcrabproducts.co.uk, and you can order lava bread from them. It's about £3.50 for 200 grams or stuff. They send it to you in the post.
Yes.
And you can, what you can do with it is you can roll it in oats and fry it as part of your Welsh cooked breakfast, you see. You love it.
Bit of fried seaweed, eh? That sounds nice for
you. But if you think back to the 17th century or whenever, when there were great famines in countries like this, and people didn't have a lot to eat, so they had to eat what was around. So they would climb down the beach and harvest this edible seaweed and cook it because they had nothing else. But I think today we are getting back to these very vitamin-rich foods because they're good for us and they're also very cheap.
Yeah, well, look, I quite agree with all of that. This is a Waitrose report, and it says Waitrose...
It would be, yes, Waitrose steals lava bread from the Welsh.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, absolutely. Waitrose, the upmarket supermarket chain. And it says they are predicting that the algae, which is what I suppose seaweed is, will become the food trend of 2021. Sales already up 23% on last year and 71% on the year before. So everybody's going to be eating seaweed. Now, I've been in Chinese restaurants and ordered a portion of seaweed, but they make it absolutely clear, I think, on the menu. It's not actually seaweed. It's what is it?
It's cabbage.
It's sugared cabbage, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. They chop it up very finely, you know, in those very fine ribbons, and they fry it. It's deep fried with, as you say, sugar on. So that's not seaweed at all. But the Japanese use a product called nori.
Nori?
And that is, yes, that is seaweed.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll believe you. Now, have you got a Louis Vuitton bag?
No.
I have.
No. Why would I want a bag with somebody else's initials stamped all over it?
Well, because it's trendy and you're one of the in crowd. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't go with that.
Yeah.
It's a bit like the Pierre Cardin thing, isn't it? Yeah. I don't want to be carrying around something that advertises somebody else.
No, okay, well, okay. Now, the reason I've got it is it's not a bag that I, you know, it's not like I walk around airports with a Louis Vuitton bag, but I've got a golf bag, which is a Louis Vuitton golf bag, okay? And the reason why is what I keep in the boot of my car is I keep this, it's only a very small golf bag and it only takes three clubs, but it's for going to what's called the driving range, you see what I mean? So, you know, I take a driver, I take an iron and maybe a second driver or something like that. And it is absolutely perfect for those three clubs. So I'm not being a poser. It's just it's the only one I've ever seen which is built to accommodate three clubs. But it is Louis Vuitton. And I have to say, it is a lovely piece of sort of luggage, you know?
It must have cost a lot of money then.
It did, yeah. Yeah, it cost a lot of money, yeah. But I thought it was worth it when I saw it in a shop somewhere. So I thought I'd get it. Anyway, the reason I mention is because you won't believe it, but Louis Vuitton have now added to their range of all sorts of design products, you know, because obviously, what did they start off? Started off with luggage, I suppose, did they?
It was bags, wasn't it? And all those trunks that people used to take on steamers.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And of course, they're owned by France's richest man, I think, Bernard Arnault, who owns LVMH, Luxury Goods Conglomerate, which includes Louis Vuitton. And the latest addition to their range is a kite. A Louis Vuitton kite, which you can buy and pack in your luggage. You know, it comes fitted into a Louis Vuitton suitcase, take it on holiday with you, and you can fly it on the beach wherever you go. And it costs only £7,000. Now,
it's taking ridiculousness to new heights, isn't it? I read about this thing and I read that it does come packaged in a tubular vessel fashioned from monogrammed canvas with a zip closure and leather shoulder strap. So you're getting a fair amount for your money then. But, I mean, Does anybody really need to flaunt their wealth to this level of heights?
Well, does anybody need a kite? Only saddos go around flying kites, don't they?
Didn't you fly a kite when you were a child?
No, never, never. I can't ever remember flying a kite.
We used to go on Blackheath, where my grandparents lived,
yeah.
And we always took kites up there, and a lot of people did. It was quite a nice thing to all gather together and fly kites.
Well, when I get down on the coast, of course, you see kites all over the place on the Solway, you know. But it's never given me a thrill to release the string with a kite at the end and see it flying in the sky. I can never see the purpose of it. Now, finally, before we go, Ms. Jones, on the survey here, which, of course, will resonate with you. Our favourite song is from When We Were 14. And we all remember that song for the rest of our lives. Does that resonate with you? Because I can't remember the song at 14. I can only remember the Beatles songs, obviously. But does that resonate with you at 14?
No, not really. I mean, somebody's just come up with this as a gimmick, haven't they? But the music that resonates most with me is the music from my very early childhood. So these were the records my father was playing. Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., all of that. And then a bit later on, T-Rex, David Bowie, Queen, Wings, that.
Yeah.
So it's not really when I was 14. And I think that's just an average number they must have plucked out of the sky.
Yes.
But I think any music from our childhood, at whatever stage we got into music, and that age is different for everybody, I think, that's the music we hark back to, really, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. But I remember the first Beatles song I ever heard.
I Feel Fine.
Yeah, that's right. I Feel Fine. Yeah. And then there was, like, you know, you 14, 15, I suppose, you were buying like New Musical Express and all that kind of stuff. But then a lot of records which are stuck in my head come from much older than 14. Through what I would call my disco era, you know what I mean? When I was king of the disco floor, dance floor. And they're things like, as you just mentioned, T-Rex and all that kind of stuff, you know, and Jeepster and all that kind of stuff, you know. But anyway, there we are.
So I suppose a bit of Barry White and a bit of...
Barry White, definitely, definitely. My favourite Barry White song is... And the Trouble With Me... Da, 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 da. He was called the Love Walrus, wasn't he?
Something About My Baby or something like that. But
yeah,
he was called the Love Walrus. I went to a barbecue at his place once.
What?
He lived next door to the Jackson family, Michael Jackson's family, in Encino, California.
Oh, in the valley, Encino Valley. Yeah.
Over the wall was Barry White, and he had his wife. I wish I could remember her name. It was
He was about 84 stone, and his wife was about 12 stone, wasn't she?
She was tiny, but she had one hand, not both hands, but one hand, her fingernails were so long that they, you know how a ram's horns kind of turn around in circles and go in on themselves? Her fingernails were like that.
Golly.
I used to look at her and think, how does she manage in the bathroom?
Oh, dear me. Please, Miss Jones, you bring it down to the basic level. Anyway, so did you skip over the wall into Barry's backyard?
Well, there was a little wooden ladder at the bottom of the garden, and we did all go over the ladder into Barry's barbecue.
Really?
And he made us very welcome indeed.
I was going to say, at his invitation, presumably, yeah.
Definitely, but that was a laugh. That was, he was huge. He was a coal mine of a man. I never met a man so large.
No, you're absolutely right, yeah.
But if you know what I mean.
Dear me, once again, I don't know, just can't get away. Take the girl out of Wales, but you know what I mean.
Bring me some lava bread.
Yeah, but I had a girlfriend once, and I got quite miffed, really, when she said, oh, no. You know, she lived in a flat with another girl, you know, and I was living in a house with two other journos, you know what I mean? And she said, oh, no, I had a great night last night. And I said, oh, really? Why? What did you do? Because, you know, I hadn't been able to see her the night before. I'd been out in the ale with some friends from the paper or something. She said, oh, yeah, she said, me and my friend lay in bed and just listened all night to, you know, replays of Barry White records. She said that, you know, the most sexiest and most erotic music in the world.
That's strange. I've always found that when Barry White comes on the radio or the CD player or whatever, that everybody jumps up and starts dancing, a bit like ABBA records.
Yeah.
So it's not something you really lie there and listen to without some action, let's say.
Well, you know, who knows? Who knows about these things? Right, okay, so there we are. Thank you very much, Miss Jones. Always a pleasure. The New Year's with us, and new podcast is with us, and got a new design. and a new presentation for it. So everybody, hope you enjoy it. And it is going to be a great year for Planet Porky. I hope it's going to be a great year for yourself, Miss Jones, and myself. And I hope it's going to be a great year for all our millions of listeners and the country itself.
Everything to play for. Keep going, everyone.
For those who are a little younger than us, she was, of course, the original girlfriend of Mick Jagger, wasn't she?
Yeah, a little unlike Edwina Curry, we'd have to say.
How do you mean?
Well, I don't think Edwina Curry probably ever had a Mars bar in Marianne Faithfull did.
Excuse me, this family show. That particular notorious episode has been denied many times by the policeman who barged into Keith Richards' home and arrested them all for taking drugs. No, not going there. No mention of Mars bars in this podcast.
So you've never done that then?
Sorry?
You've never done that then?
Excuse me, I'm not going there, Miss Jones. For goodness sake, you know. God, blimey, I don't know.
Over the wall was Barry White, and he had his wife. I wish I could remember her name. It
was he was about 84 stone, and his wife was about 12 stone, wasn't she?
She was tiny, but she had on one hand, not both hands, but one hand, her fingernails were so long that they, you know how a ram's horns kind of turn around in circles and go in on themselves? Her fingernails were like that.
Golly. Yeah.
And I used to look at her and think, how does she manage in the bathroom?
Oh, dear me. Please, Miss Jones, you bring it down another basic level. She said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Mike Parrot from the Daily Express." And she said, "Well, fuck off." And then closed the window. And that was it. That's as far as I got.